Time to check back in with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy for a Tacky Talk update. How are you, Tacky?
Hey, Joe. It's good to see you after a couple windy nights.
Yes, but this is my kind of snowstorm. Doesn't even happen.
Well, there was a slight coating in my car. As you all know, I live off of Black's Creek Marsh. It was a slight coating in the car, but this morning, I think the wind just blew it all off.
Exactly. Yeah. So I said before, if I never see snow again, it'll be too soon. It's okay with me.
As we are both old enough to remember the April Fool's storm. So we're not quite out of the woods yet.
Yes, I'm old enough to remember May snowstorm many years ago. So no, don't put the shovels away just yet.
Exactly. And keep the de-icer handy just in case. So,
yep.
But unfortunately, power has not been that bad. Power losses were not that bad on the South Shore. We're all Quincy. Had some intermittent power outages in the city. National Grid crews have been out, as well as other contracted crews by National Grid. And hopefully everybody's had power restored at this point in the greater area of Quincy. Certain areas a little bit more susceptible because of trees, and historically I've had some difficulties in points of Walls and Hill, West Quincy, Quincy Point. South Quincy have, had power issues in the past. So oddly enough, those of us live on the water, may have lights flicker, but shockingly, it's actually fairly stable in the coastline. I do know lights flicker. I do know some people lose some power, but shockingly, it's not like a massive outage along the waterfront, despite the winds.
Yeah, and fortunately, the flooding didn't materialize either, which was good news.
Well, I have a front view of the tide gates in the water retention area of Black's Creek. I mean, you literally have a front door view. And, city operating those tide gates at the right time with the tidal cycle close, ensures the water from, West Quincy through Cunningham and Furnace Brooks coming out of Milton and West Quincy, is able to control the flow of water in and out. And when the basin is full, it flows out fast when the tide is low. So, and of course, those of who live in Adam Shore and the neck knows of the different tide gates that are sitting in the marshlands out there, and city's responsibility to be able to get those up and down at the right moments, helps a lot. And we are able to avoid astronomical high tide. If this was astronomical high tide, I think it would have been, I won't say it was as bad as 2017, but I mean, it could have been really close.
Yeah, for sure. If it was last week when the tides were astronomically high, it would have been a whole different story. So thankfully we dodged that bullet.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the living coastal communities, the tide really does matter. And even if you live up, up on a hill area, or even in the west side of the sea, those tides do matter regarding the ability to get water out of the system. And this includes Town Brook. Most people forget that Town Brook travels right into the Town Brook marshland area, right through Quincy Center, and all those culverts that were moved around like three different times in the last 10 years to do the Quincy downtown project. But those culverts, are pretty important. And I'm aware certain parts of the city will flood no matter what will happen. They're just inside a bowl. And, obviously where I live in Walson, the most common one we know of is the one by 91 Clay Street, the CVS on Clay Street and Beale. That is the bowl. And Walson Station is also a bowl. It's not hard to figure out. You look at Walson Hill one side, it's flat on the other, and, it scoops back up. Part of the Walson Station rebuild included better pump out of water and redesigned utilities in the surrounding area, so they have reduction of risk regarding flood damage to the electrical system. Well, will it be damaged? Sure. I mean, you get to a 100-year storm, a catastrophic storm. I mean, nothing's going to stop a catastrophic storm. I'm sorry, folks. I mean, if it's bad enough, any infrastructure will fail. But I mean, in major 50-year storms, I think that Walls and Station will hold up.
Well, seeing as you brought up the T, Tacky.
I mean, the fact that you can't get anywhere quick on the T, it was bad before and worse now. I've been hearing from folks. Yeah, no surprise that you all know at this stage that the MBTA has been subject to an enormous review regarding a safety record, as well as the lack of employees working there. I mean, filling 1,000 positions is not as easy as it sounds at the T. I remember the old days where, your brother and your cousin kept calling a politician for a job at the T, and for some reason, 1,000-person vacancies. I mean, how has the world changed, right? But, there are a lot of work being done on the T right now regarding replacement of the rail systems, as well as the ties and some, you know, unfortunate incidents regarding things like maintenance vehicles collapsing or crashing on the tracks, you know, 4 a.m. and got the Milton railway station, heavy equipment collapse. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, it all hits like it's like, you know, bad luck in threes. I mean, I'm like 10 days, three bad things hit at once. So the MBTA, you know, informs us that hopefully by, I know it's going to be off of the sound, hopefully by the beginning of April, a lot of this maintenance work will be complete and they'll run through the safety standards at night to ensure they can travel at their normal speeds. It's about 10 to 15 miles an hour in certain sections. If you're above ground, there is a speed limit. If I remember, it's been a long time, but I remember correctly, it's around 40 miles an hour above ground.
Right.
Yeah. And I think below ground, it's about 20. That below ground is really difficult because of the fact that those who ride a T know that it's not a straight line. It winds. And you try to do 40 miles on the ground and it winds, your train's going to just derail. So even at 10, 5, 10, 15, more like 10 and 5 on the ground, you know, it is absolutely brutal, brutal on people. And, you know, even though 20 doesn't sound that fast, you know, comparatively speaking, it looks like lightning.
Yeah, well, especially when you're traveling, you know, relatively short distances when you think about it. So, yeah, you can get to where you're going to in a good amount of time at 20 miles per hour.
Yeah, I mean, the speed, you know, speed really does matter. And you're right, it's a relatively short distance. You're talking from Walsall Station to downtown crossing, you know, somewhere in the area of under 9 miles.
Right, yeah.
So it is relatively short. It was running at normal speeds, you know, if there's no accidents, you know, no other, you know, mishaps, you know, you could be downtown relatively good pace.
One, the biggest issue this time around seems to be a management issue with documentation of work that's already been done. So that just seems to be like a paperwork issue that fell through the cracks.
Well, this is a reflection of the incompetency of the team management going back to Deval Patrick and Mitt Romney. I mean, you know, that everyone's presentations way back when where they're making recommendations in the T and PowerPoints. I know we don't do reports even in government, it's PowerPoints. It's ridiculous, by the way, they should do PowerPoints. But it's a reflection every time there's new management. They decide to scrap or start over, reevaluate every single thing going on, even stuff that's already moved past a design and engineering phase and put to halt. And documentation, that stuff's very problematic because the various management teams can't hold it together. And honestly, a lot of these management teams these days are not MBTA employees moving through the ranks. They're outsiders that come in. Some are legit, some are hacks. Let's call it what it is. And they just don't care. It's not a big part of their careers. And what we really need at MBTA, again, it's not a new story. We need consistent leadership that will have people who are career folks that do this for a living and not somebody's bloody cousin that needs a job. And, you know, I know for a fact Deval Patrick, you know, had one of those situations and they had to move that situation. I'm not Deval Patrick. Charlie Baker had one of those situations, had to move it out because I had a friend displaced over at economic development because they needed to move this guy out of the MBTA fast, and they replaced the Vietnamese guy with the white guy because they thought it'd be an easier target. So obviously move out the person of color. So, I mean, I'm fully aware of what goes on there. Most of you probably aren't aware about because, you know, I have friends in government, regardless of political party affiliation. I have friends like everybody else everywhere in government. And, you know, I do hear some of these stories and some actually do impact people I've known for many, many years. But it's, you know, a troublesome 30-something white guy goes out and eliminates, you know, 60-year-old person of color, takes away that person's job because it was a nuisance at MBTA.
Hmm. Isn't this, I mean, the Department of Public Utilities is supposed to be the overseer agency, though, right, to maintain the standards.
Yeah, for some reason, oddly, transportation issues has always been under DPU authority. That even back when there's ODTE, when I first started working here, you know, it was telecom and energy as opposed to public utilities. And that includes towing rates and taxi rates and things like that. And Uber and Lyft stuff is under their review as well. And to be honest with you, again, this is a failure of the Baker administration to actually focus this. I also blame Deval Patrick. Let's go back in time. When they created this agency of economic development housing and put DPU underneath it. You know, they basically, I'm sorry, energy environment, DPU is on energy environment. They restructured that focus of the agency to be just about energy and energy issues and targeting renewable energy, as opposed to holding utilities accountable and ratepayer safety. And I've never heard of a major crisis at that agency until recently. It is a refocus, going back from Deval Patrick, changing its mission statement. I don't buy this crap about DPU saying, oh, we don't have sufficient funding and all this stuff. They're ratepayer funded. They're not taxpayer funded. If they need money to do their job, there is ready money, because taxpayers don't pay for it. Ratepayers, you know, frankly, it's like 0.0001 cent on the dollar to a taxpayer to increase the funding. Ratepayer to increase the funding on funding DPU facilities. So, you know, I don't buy this argument, because, you know, the previous administration and the previous administration, you know, changed the focus of what DPU's purpose, because prior to that, and I've been around too long now, you know, there was no major crises regarding transportation review. I mean, people remember the Fung Wah bus, and the DPU was over that, like cellophane. I mean, they were there, inspections moved in right away, and they, you know, restructured the bus review system over DPU. So, you know, whether the Healey administration recognizes what DPU should be about, we'll wait and see. But this was not a problem before. Again, I heavily blame two governors now who charge people down there to not do the whole job. Okay, folks? You know, they didn't charge people down to do the whole job. They only focus on what was relevant policy issues for the governor. And it's a quasi-judicial agency, which means that it actually has Chapter 30 administration and enforcement and civil penalty powers. And I've always been taught, as a matter of public policy, if you're a quasi-judicial agency, you know, you should be left at some independence, because you don't want to be influenced by political factors affecting the governor's public policy in order to further the interests of the governor.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, the MWRA is a similar system, is it not?
That's correct. MWRA is under the quasi system because of the fact that it does operate independently of taxpayers, and in that case, and also operates on its own bonding mechanism. It is not a judicial agency, unlike DPU, which is a judicial agency, because you don't think of it that way, but it really is, because it's adjudicating cases between the utilities and AG's office, right? Yeah. The MBTA is not like that. Massport's another quasi agency. While the governor has appointments in the board of directors, which actually helps choose the next CEO, it is pretty much independently funded from taxpayers, making most money on fees and rentals. And it has its own bonding component. The UMass system isn't quasi, because the state is a huge financial investor in the higher education system, the state higher education system. But each individual school, you know, has its own chancellor and provost, which are separate from the UMass president's office. And they have their own different board of trustees at each of the schools. Mm-hmm. So I find the UMass system a little peculiar because of the way the president's office is structured and their questionable ability to actually run individual campus. I mean, each campus should be run independently of the president's office in many ways. That is one quirky one in terms of quasi-public. And obviously, MBTA is also quasi-public. It's an independent board of directors. I have actually no influence in who gets on that board. They're taxpayer-funded, but they're not taxpayer-funded in a conventional manner, because the taxpayer funding is automatic. It comes out of one penny, not a percentage, one penny of your sales tax. So it's completely subject to economic factors associated with the economy. And when this was put into place around 2000, you've one individual, Joe Sullivan, who put it into place, you know, the former transportation chair and former mayor of Braintree. You're more than welcome to ask him. He knows it better than I do. You know, the projection was basically trying to tie the MBTA revenue to inflation. Mm. The sales tax as we've seen right now, is an inflationary indicator for the state, because we collect most sales tax when prices are up. Unfortunately, for the MBTA, it is not a steady inflation indicator. We've had almost zero inflation, like under 1% at certain stages from 2000, basically 10 to 2008. Or I'm sorry, not 10, 2000, can't do dates today. 2010 to basically, you know, right up to the last 2 years.
Right. So 20 years, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the well past a decade plus, the MBTA has seen very little sales tax benefit because there's really almost no inflation. And you guys all know now that you have higher inflation, we collect more sales tax, and we're going to start to deflate. Everything looks like deflation. We can move into the next topic about recession coming, as well as people cutting back on spending on everything. Will impact the MBTA, which is funded from sales tax. Also impacts the school building assistance program, which is also funded from sales tax. I mentioned the quarter 1.75% the cities and towns collect. So cities and towns actually have a pretty good indicator about the strength of the restaurant industry. And obviously we collect that as well. And that's actually, one of the way we know restaurants are doing all right, specifically on the municipal level. If their projections on shortfall, the 0.75% collection on meals tax from the city and town, we all know the strength of the restaurant industry based on the meals tax revenue system.
Sure, makes perfect sense. Yeah, it's the numbers don't lie. They tell the story in literally black and white.
Yeah, and municipality in particular can gauge the strength of that specific municipality because of the 0.75 collection they take on your meals tax. So, when I was talking to Councillor Chuck Phelan, back during pandemic about the budget component, we were talking about this. I figured the meals tax would be suffering. Those meals tax came up almost on target for the following FY21 budget for the city because of takeout. And frankly, you and me and everyone else doing our best to try to support our local businesses by buying local, literally buying local as often as we could, as much as we could afford.
A lot of folks pivoted, had a quick outdoor dining setups, used these delivery services. So yeah.
Yeah, your support is reflected in the city's meals tax collection. I don't, I mean, you have to talk to, I've not asked again, but I'm sure when you next talk to the mayor, you can make an inquiry about the meals tax collection of the last cycle and going to the next cycle. And I will tell you, they're going to tell you it's pretty strong.
So we're talking finances, Jackie. We should definitely talk about the banking situation that just developed over the past couple of days. I know last time you and I chatted, we had discussed savings rates going up because interest rates are going up. Now it seems to have had a negative effect, at least on these couple of banks.
Yeah, I mean, you had essentially three banks. You had Silvergate, which is a crypto company bank. So they're another FTX-ish type bank where they use your crypto monies and treat it like a bank fund, but they're not really a bank either. They're not FDIC type bank. It's wacky. So basically, they use your crypto as collateral or basically loan that money out or try to make money on your crypto money and then make money for the bank that way and pay you your interest as part of the deal, which is kind of the FTX scam when they say, I'm going to take your, $2 million in crypto and then I'm going to invest it, something, and I'm going to give you a cut of the action as a result. And I get the difference. Bank, conventional banking is that you make a deposit, the bank uses your deposit to give out a loan to be able to make money back, and you get a cut of the action alone. And as we discussed in the past already, interest rates going up, mortgage rates are going up, lending rates go up, but your savings and checking account has not gone up because the bank is pocketing the difference, folks. It's not hard math. If you got a 7% mortgage and you're making 0.1% interest rate, where's the difference, right? And the other thing that's out there is that people forget banks aren't fully funded. And we talked about the pension system a lot, fully funding the pension system. So, my joke is always like, you watch the old Beverly Hills Hillbillies. Maybe you remember that show if you're old enough. And Uncle Jed would constantly go to the bank and ask to see his oil money, right? He wants to physically see his money. And that's not an unreasonable request. I think all of us would like to see my cash, safely in a giant safe, knowing that that cash is my cash. And obviously, they can't show that because it doesn't exist in physical cash. It's all electronic and tallying on paper, so to speak. And they've already loaned that money out to another business for the so then so the banking money, and then also the customer can make some money off that interest rate. But nowadays, you got things like Silicon Valley Bank, SVB Financial, and Signature is actually a crypto situation. But SVB is a kind of a niche bank targeting small business, healthcare in particular, technology in particular, startup. They basically demand that if you do venture capital through that bank, you have to be a depositor of the bank as well. You can't diversify deposits. Businesses that reach a certain size should diversify the deposits for two reasons. One is the FDIC $250,000 insurance. If you're a small enough business, definitely want to diversify for insurance purposes. And secondly, you know, try to get the best interest rates based on the banks you are, so you can maximize your money at different locations. But SVB doesn't let that happen. They don't really put in contract, but basically tell you that if you want our help when you're financing your startup company, you better bank with us. So there isn't, as seen by the papers, you know, somewhere between 93 and 95% of all depositors are FDIC insured, which means that they're large business accounts. They're not, you know, they're not predominantly small depositors like yourself or your neighbor who do not have $250,000 on hand to drop into a bank account. I mean, many of us wish we had that kind of luxury, but I don't, and neither do you, most likely.
I do not, no.
So what they did was that the SVB, of course, wanted to make money on their money. So again, they, you know, use your money to help start up other businesses, but also heavily invested in long-term bonds prior to interest rate increase. So they were looking at bond rates of like 1% or less. And now we got bond rates, long-term bond rates, you know, between 3.5 and 4 plus. All those dropped like a stone. It's like 3.6 for long-term bonds of a decade. And as a result, you know, once people started needing money because of inflationary costs, you got to make payroll, you got to make, you know, pay your bills, they need money, and they're going to start withdrawing more. Well, the mismanagement of the bank is they never kept enough cash reserves for people to withdraw because of the inflationary period. When you do business, you need more money now to pay, you know, electric bills, crazy, right? So you got to pay more. So that means you're going to dip more into your savings as these guys have cash reserves trying to keep up with their bills. Well, eventually you're going to withdraw more than you physically have in money. So that's where the problem lies. And then SVB would sell those bonds at very low interest rate at a loss, amounting to over $1.8 billion loss or whatever, some enormous money. So now they have to do a capital raise, meaning they're going to have to sell common stock because this is a publicly traded bank. And even a private trade, like Colonial Federal is a privately trading bank. It's my bank. They have private stock, common stock. But in their case, they decided to do a massive stock sale of like over $2 billion. And that sent signals to capital venturists and other major depositors, like, what are you doing? And then, you know, why would you do a capital raise if you didn't have any money? Because that's the point of a capital raise. And they did it publicly, and they basically told everybody we didn't have any money. They basically publicly announced it to their major depositors. It probably wasn't a press release that most big people didn't pick it up till later. As a result, people started pulling tens of millions of dollars out to try to move into safe harbors and other banks. And then it started what we know as a bank run. You guys seen this in the movie A Wonderful Life, right? You know, when they were making a run at George's bank and they were trying to get their money out, and George is trying to at least keep some deposits in place so you're considered not bankrupt. Well, you know, that's what happened. So as a result, SVB, you know, trading had to stop on the floor of the I think they're an S&P company. So it had to stop trading. The regulators moved in within a day. I mean, overnight they moved in and seized assets, shut the bank down, fired everybody, and then had to come up with a solution over the weekend. And you know, the Treasury, the Fed Reserve, and the FDIC, which is an independent federal agency who's in charge of keeping our deposits safe and investigating these situations, made the determination that the best thing to do is use the FDIC insurance to make all depositors whole, which has never been done, to my knowledge, to the extent, like 100% whole, not just the $250,000 limit and all depositors, but if you're a shareholder or executive or employee, well, you're out to dry. You know, FDIC and California banking regulators are trying to keep employees there long enough for the transition. So I'm sure regulators are trying to figure out how to pay employees they need to keep there long enough to transition the bank someplace else. So now they're trying to sell the bank. It's going to have to be a breakup. So the big thing is people want to buy the mortgages. Mortgages are good to buy because mortgages means you're going to get money out of it. So you buy a mortgage at a discount, you make up the difference. You know, mortgage is paid by the person that owes you the money. It ain't hard math. You buy a discount and they pay you back and you make the difference. But taking over the depositors and other functions of the bank is much more harder because it's a loss. And then you would have to, you know, use your bank deposits. Hence, you got to be a mega bank because you're looking at $200 billion here. So you got to be like a uber-sized bank to be able to adopt it. And SVB was the eighth biggest bank in the US. Mm. So one of the biggest banks in England is going to, you know, buy the deposits, buy the mortgages and try to take over the branches, the ones in England, HSCB, I believe. And then there is exposure in Asia. And you've seen these branches in Massachusetts too. Signature Bank that got closed over the weekend is a crypto-oriented bank, similar to Silvergate. It's not exactly the same either. It is a charter bank. It is a regular bank. Silvergate was a regular bank in a weird way. But as a result, you know, they got closed out. But they're a little bit quirky. Because again, they're a crypto bank. They're moving crypto money around. And at a certain point, you know, crypto, as you've seen, crypto prices have fallen like a rock, you know, during the high bond, high interest rate period. Because people rather take low risk on their money by bonds and CDs, you know, crypto had less value. And now you see the banking industry tumbling on Wall Street, not just here, but also in Europe, very bad in Europe overnight. Crypto has gone up in value, particularly Bitcoin. And you got Credit Suez, which is one of the biggest banks on the planet, trading at like $1.50 or whatever, like tiny amounts on Wall Street. They've been in a financial banking crisis for a better part of a year now, and it looks like it may collapse. So the entire European continent, you know, including the British and everybody else, you know, needs this bank functional. And the Swiss bank is having enormous problems with liquidity. They don't have enough money. And they try not to send negative signals to the public, because if they send negative signals, as you saw at SVB, I'm not keeping my money there if you're going to go out of business. I mean, I'm getting out.
Well, that's the big fear. I think that's why the FDIC insured everybody wholly, because they wanted to avoid that situation.
Well, and they're trying to avoid other banks going into it. These are regional banks, right? SVB, you know, has some branches here, but they're really a Bay Area, California, San Francisco Bay Area bank and the Silicon Valley Bank. I mean, no kidding. Who do you think to target audiences, right? It's in the name. Right. But it's impacted other regional banks that are big banks that help support these small business ventures. So if you're in like a little regional bank up here, you know, like by Colonial Federal, I wouldn't be that concerned. They're a low risk bank. They're not looking for high risk investments. You know, they're much more conventional and the deposits are much smaller. So they have very little interest in risk. For them to make their money. And, you know, same thing with like Eastern. People ask me, well, with Eastern and Bank of America, you know, which is a mega bank, and Eastern, which is a regional bank, or Santander. And I'm like, I wouldn't be too concerned. I wouldn't be making a bank run on them. They're not the same exposure to crypto. They're not the same exposure to venture capital, small business. And they're also subject to Frank Dodd, a little higher scrutiny in the big banks. Well, you know, in 2018, the Republicans and Donald Trump repealed a lot of their Frank Dodd provisions on regional small banks, which SVB was actively lobbying for, and also dumping a lot of, you know, lobbying and campaign donations to Republicans. So, you know, could it just prevented? Don't know. Could it have been better warning signs that we knew was coming? The answer is probably yes.
Yeah. With the FDIC system, Jackie, it's really not clear. Is it $250,000 limit per account or per customer?
Yeah, the website is a little quirky when you read it. So, you know, per class. So, for example, different classes of banking. So you have like a savings account and a checking account. They're considered the same class. But if you have a business account versus a savings account, it's two different classes, and it gets really quirky. So you have to really know with your bank what different classes are, so you have an idea of that. However, if you're at physically different corporations, different banks, the FDIC is $250,000. So for example, if I took $250,000 at Colonial, I wish I had that much money, and then, you know, $250,000 is out of Santander across down the street from them, I'll be FDIC insured for both $250,000, so all $500,000. But if you're also a married joint account couple, it's $500,000 coverage. So if you're at any bank and you have a coupled bank account, that's $500,000 coverage, FDIC. And again, if you have multiple banks that could do that, but you can be at the same bank if you have class accounts, different classes. So you haven't actually talked to your bank about that. And then also some banks will offer a multiple deposit services. And it's not for every bank, but you know, some of the bigger banks will offer the ability for them too. They will manage moving your deposits to different banks and different classes on your behalf, not just at their bank, but also other banks to ensure they get maximum FDIC coverage. And, you know, some people who are spending time saving money their entire lives, let's say to like a million five, for example, and you're going to live off that pension for the rest of your life. And, you know, by the time either one of us pension out, a million five is probably not a lot of money, sadly, given the rate of inflation and costs. But, you know, but you're concerned about the safety of your money. You're probably at that point really not interested in investing any of that. You know, you may ask, you know, a large bank to ask you to spread your deposits around to maximize FDIC insurance against a potential bank fallout. That is a service that's out there with some of the larger banks. If you have that much asset and you're not interested in investing in the market or in, you know, T-bonds or anything like that, you know, definitely talk to, you know, your banker about the possibility of can they provide FDIC protection by shared deposits in multiple bank or multiple classes of accounts. It is worth an ask if, you, if you're that concerned, if you have that level of money available.
Yeah.
So, I mean, would I do a bank run? I wouldn't be too concerned. I know that the market is down on big banks like JP Morgan and others, but that's a reflection of just raw panic on the banking industry by major depositors. But I mean, if you're a local banker, I wouldn't worry about it. But if you're, you know, a bank that you know, or you're a business owner that has exposure to venture capitalist stuff, maybe you should get yourself down to the 250 market and move on to someplace else.
Sure. Let's talk a little bit about the governor just announced today, actually, the lifting of the COVID restrictions in coincidence with the federal government on May 11th.
Yeah, I think most of us don't even notice this anymore.
I think you're right. But the emergency order is still technically in place, right?
Yeah, she has her essentially war powers. As you may remember, the emergency powers come back from a post-World War II period. And the reflection of a different time. And it's very broad and very vague and very powerful for a governor in case of a state of emergency. And it's been used multiple times, whether it be a snowstorm for 24 hours or the Boston bombing that went on for weeks, where the governor could mobilize an enormous amount of forces to deal with a terrorist attack. Of course, COVID has never been anticipated under this law because, again, it's a post-World War II law. And yeah, I've been living like this and most people haven't even noticed. The only other mandate I think most people realize is really the healthcare mandate regarding going to hospitals, which those, you know, I have an immune compromised mom, I take her to doctor's appointments regularly at Tufts Medical Center. And frankly, you know, massive fight of me, especially inside a hospital where there's other people that are not well. And obviously you see me at events more often. My mom's going over different treatments, so my caution level has got considerably higher. So I've been try to be more safe than before, not necessarily against COVID, but also, you know, RSP, which has gone rampant this past winter, and no one likes the norovirus. I mean, no one, that's one that everyone wants to avoid at all costs. But honestly, I mean, who's going to notice? I mean, unless there's some kind of resurgence of a healthcare crisis, I mean, it's going to go out of effect. You get some political hoo-ha about it, and then whatever, life goes on as we've been going on already.
Yeah. Does it change any compensation though for, say, small business owners or healthcare professionals, you know, healthcare workers in the field?
Not really. I mean, a lot of the financial support the state and the feds, or the state via the feds, depending on the funding sources, now already have all gone out. I mean, people remember the PPP. We didn't tax PPP. The state did not tax it. The feds didn't tax it. You got off scot-free. It's free money. Shockingly, such a thing existed during COVID. Of course, everyone remembered the stimulus dollars for every person. People remember the tax credits that have now expired in the federal level for people with children. Expanded SNAP benefits have ended by the feds. We're supplementing the SNAP expanded benefits to some level, but no guarantee it's going to make an appearance next budget. I mean, free school breakfast was a big thing with the feds. We provided that in last year's budget, free school lunches. We're going to cover the cost for the renter fiscal cycle and see if we can afford to cover it. I do support that. But again, it depends whether we can cover those costs that the feds are no longer going to be doing. You know, we still got the Medicare, Medicaid problem, which the speaker, which is very much more knowledgeable about this stuff, about trying to keep the local hospitals alive. We were borrowing against the Medicare trust fund. You know, unemployment trust fund, as you guys all know, during 2020, we basically exhausted the whole thing in less than 9 months during 2020. And we didn't tax those benefits either, in the sense that we used the same deductible. as the federal government. So, you know, the state didn't fully collect against your unemployment benefits either. We left a lot of money at the table. I think there's zero appreciation by anybody in the business community, especially how much money the state left on the table that we're legally allowed to take. Mm-hmm. But we're neither here nor there about that. So, you know, a lot of that, you know, stimulus money is already gone. And then you also got the ARPA money we rolled out, plus also state targeted, federal targeted money that you all know, you know, the mayor bought a bunch of property with. And some other city and towns uses bonuses or COVID pay for their public employees. And some folks put into a different infrastructure, such as air purifiers. And some people use the money to help cover, you know, local businesses to, you know, get a one more hump through COVID. I mean, everybody in the municipal level used it differently. So it's not a, you know, straight rule, and state has zip oversight about how that worked out. So, you know, and the money went to higher ed. A lot of that money went to higher ed to support higher ed when there were no students there, help them get through those periods. And so, yeah, a lot of money in 2021 in particular. Either the state and feds didn't take tax money from you. We gave you money, or the feds gave you money. And then, you know, we had our own distribution is targeting small businesses, you know, people in need and whatnot. So, yeah, we're done. I mean, we're done. Unless there's some other crises, we're done. I mean,
yeah. Let's hope not. You know what? I want to ask you. Can you explain? I'm sure you can. The because this has come up during the Quincy teacher contract talks. The paid Family Medical Leave Act in Massachusetts, and I mean, everybody sure. pays into it every week. Isn't that available to anybody?
Yeah. So the paid Family Leave Act is the employees and employers pay as a part of their payroll taxes into a paid family leave trust fund, and then you can actually, as a employee, once you qualify, can draw out of that fund, which I think it's similar qualification period as, I'm trying to figure out what the qualification is. They similar like to unemployment. It has the same kind of standards. And basically you collect similar to unemployment benefits. There is a cap. It is 100% of your salary. It's tied to the medium household income of the state. It's about two thirds ish of the medium household income. So it's not like you're guaranteed 100% of your salary. You basically get money as if you're unemployment.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you're going to take paid family leave, please anticipate what it is and don't assume it's going to be the size of your paycheck.
Okay.
And
so it's kind of a base. It's a base, basically.
Yeah. And in many countries that does paid family leave, surprisingly, not everybody takes it for the full term. They only need to just get through the period of time you get through, you know, early on, whether it be caring for a loved one or a new baby coming home. You know, a lot of folks kind of have a idea of what trying to get themselves set up and situated, and not having children myself, I'm sure the first couple of months is a huge adjustment at home. But I have no idea; I've never experienced it. But I'm sure,
especially a first child. Yeah,
I'm sure many families can come on and talk to you about those challenges.
I'm sure.
But obviously, I have friends of children, so I do hear yep. about it. But it's municipalities would actually have to participate themselves to want to do it. The state is mandated to participate in paid family leave. Businesses are small; certain small businesses are exempt. Municipalities have to choose to participate.
Okay, so it's different if you work for a municipality.
Yeah, I believe Boston has a paid family leave. I believe it's part of their collective bargaining contract. I believe.
Okay.
I need to double check this, but I believe municipalities, they have to adopt paid family leave, and the unions have been pushing for the municipalities to adopt a paid family leave program. Again, you still have employer and employee share costs. It isn't like it's a freebie.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Thanks for explaining that. I appreciate that.
Yeah. I'll double check that. If I'm wrong, we'll come back next week.
Okay. That sounds good. Russia's crashing into drones, Tacky.
I love it when a general of the U.S. Army tells you you're incompetent. I love the position of the U.S. government. It's kind of like, well, it wasn't an attack. You're just not good at your job.
We just don't know how to fly.
Yeah. I mean, it's a worse insult than saying you're attacked. It's an interesting piece of diplomacy when you say that. We weren't attacked. You're just not good at your job. I'm not surprised. I mean, the Black Sea is considered, the Russians consider the Black Sea their territory, despite the fact it's shared waters with Turkey and other states in the region, as well as the fact the middle part of it is considered international waters.
Right.
And it's not surprising U.S. drones. I think everyone knows drones exist, but they're also used for surveillance because as much as you have spy satellites, your spy satellite has been the right place, right time, all the time to see something. It's not like they're this massive, you know, ability to telescopic view every single moment. So
right. It orbits the Earth, right? Yeah.
Exactly. So drone surveillance is not surprising with high-tech cameras and all that and can get good pictures, you know, miles and miles away. It's just this one was spotted by Russian jets and continued tension between Russia and literally everybody, it feels like. Supposedly, you know, a jet crashed into the propeller. I just can't figure how you would do that.
All I could think of is that the pilot was texting and not paying attention. I don't know.
The text by flying, right?
Exactly, so, yeah.
So I do know there is a Western tint regarding the war in Ukraine. I mean, I'm not oblivious to that. But it's hard to argue with the video coverage and the just, you know, death count going on with the horrors of war. The video doesn't lie. You know, the Russians said 3 days and it's been well over a year. So, you know, the if it's true that a Russian jet crashed itself into a drone, U.S. drone, I mean, no wonder you're having problems over there. The U.S. general says you're just basically incompetent. It's basically what they called you, unprofessional incompetent.
Yeah, international, like, slight.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically military slapping another professional saying you guys are just bad at your job. You know, turns out to be true, and I'm sure there's going to be some kind of satellite footage showing this at some point. I mean, what else do you need to know? I mean, you know, like I said, I am aware how the media portrays things, but at some point, the video doesn't lie.
Right. We never even talked about what's going on in Beacon Hill over the past week. Jackie, anything?
Not too much. The House Speaker's office, we had a leadership meeting of chairs and vice chairs regarding, some of the agenda setting for the cycle, discussion of operation of committees. Those of you may not know, there's always tension between the House and Senate regarding how to operate committees. Obviously, my preference to work in a cooperative manner. I'm on my fourth Senate chair as chair of the current committee I'm in. So as again, it's developing a relationship. My co-chair is Senator John Cronin from Fitchburg, who oddly enough has Quincy ties. His mom's from Quincy, from North Quincy. Mm. Yeah, he knows North Quincy better than me. We had a good chat. There were a lot of commonalities that we could talk about, and I'm slightly older. Actually, I'm a lot older than him. Much to my dismay. I don't know how it's going to go. I mean, we had a great dinner and a chance to get to know each other. This is a relationship-driven business, and relationships take a lot of work. And to develop relationships with my colleagues on Beacon Hill is not like, you know, walk in, walk out. You have to spend time with people. Text, phone, coffee, lunch, dinner. I mean, it's legit work, people. I mean, you can't hi, and then you got to get what you want. It doesn't work.
Like any relationship, you have to foster it.
Yeah, and like my previous co-chair, Sue Moran from Barnstable, and Paul Feeney from, where's Paul from? Foxborough. Yeah, that's right. It has to do with the Patriots. It just dawned on me. The Patriots.
The Patriots.
You're coming up with the Patriot issue. Foxborough with them. Yeah, you see the pause I just had. Oh, yeah, that's right. Patriots. Barbara Letalian, who's no longer a senator from Andover, had a different relationship with all of them over a two-year period. The first 6 months, takes a bit of time to trust each other. Mm. And get a feel about, you know, what you're about. And then, you know, working relationship really develops from there. It isn't just like, hey, how you doing? And suddenly you just make things happen. It isn't that way. And then staff got the bills. I've been told I have 243 bills in committee. We're now evaluating what the bills are, and we're discharge bills that doesn't belong to us to another committee if it makes sense. So there'll be some coordination between us, other chairs, and sponsors of bills about moving some bills around and then set up a hearing schedule. Staff and I have been discussing that, and we'll probably use the same schedule like last year, post Senate budget, and just run nonstop right through into the beginning of August and keep running through September to October and try to move bills out along the way. So I suspect there'll be another probably 10 plus bills coming in next 10 or so weeks that are late filed bills. So it's a pretty steep learning curve for my co-chair in the sense that he was never on the committee before. So he's first time at it. And you can't just ram things down people's throats. We all know that's not polite. I think it's always good professional courtesy to give people a little bit of space, and it'll frustrate advocates, it'll frustrate lobbyists, it'll frustrate special interest groups, it'll frustrate you all at home if you have an interest in my committee. But it's, even though I know the issue, you got to give my co-chair a chance to learn the issue as well. And that's how you build a trusting relationship that we can work towards.
So are you going to the St. Patrick's Day breakfast tacky in South Boston?
Nope. I've done maybe like four of those. I think I've got text messages of people seeing me on TV every so often because I had a few seats at the table for the purpose of television. So once the day goes long and other people leave, they just start throwing people in the seats to keep the optics going. It can be a lot of fun, but I think most of you agree that if you watch this a long time, the Bolger days were probably the best.
That's what we all remember, is him singing away. Yes.
Yeah, and this is very scripted for television. Even then, I'm not even sure what channel it's on this time, to be honest with you. It used to be like Channel 56 back in the day, did NECN, it hit C-SPAN for a bit, and I don't know where it is now.
Yeah, I don't either. It's not on here, I can tell you that.
honestly, it's more of a TV production. I mean, if you ever attend this event, you need to pause for TV commercial breaks and all that stuff. It isn't just a continuous run. And of course, on television, I mean, in sensitivities of today's world, you kind of have to kind of pick and choose more carefully how you tell a joke. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, some jokes, folks, are not exactly designed for your feelings. I mean, you got to have understand the humor in it. And I think that's also very risky for elected officials to do. No, it's not like a small pride event that we used to have in Quincy. We're not doing it this year, but I think Dedham is still going on. And there's no cameras in Dedham, so it tends to be like, anybody that's a public figure is open game.
Yeah.
There's a fine line between tasteful and funny and just straight up mean.
Yeah, it's true. It's a delicate balance these days, for sure.
Yeah, and if you're not like really good at it, you flub. Everyone remembers you're terrible. So yeah. That's kind of the other fear out there regarding telling a joke. So,
all right, well, we won't look for you there then.
No, you won't see me on TV this Sunday on this stuff, but...
But you'll see you here on TV, QATV.
we will always be here with you on QATV. There's always something fun to talk about going on. But it's actually, oddly enough, a pretty quiet St. Patrick's. And I still think I know people are bringing back to life a lot of stuff that was pre-COVID. But I also think a lot of people to organize things prior to COVID. I mean, it's almost 3 years later. Or now 3 years later, actually, it's not March. People have moved on or moved to different things, and frankly, people got 3 years older.
That's right too. Yeah.
And organizing people organized 3 years ago may not be interested or able to organize 3 years down the road and didn't have a chance to transition. So I do expect that some events in general in the state, will be different. Because different organizers or may not be around or in hiatus until new organization people come in.
Right. Yeah. All righty. This is the time of the program where I asked you to let folks know how to get a hold of you.
Sure. 617-722-2370, 617-722-2370. I shouldn't have to remind people of this, but we are indeed open to the public. Come in for tours, come and see the family. You can visit things around the State House. Obviously, school tours will be beginning at some point again as we get to warmer weather. I'm in room 42. I have not moved. So I got a new roommate, suite mate, Mike Finn from West Springfield. He's the chair of bonding, moved into Lita Moran's door, who is now my joy leader, moved upstairs. So you're going to see some nameplate changes going on in front of room 42. You can always email me at tackey.chan, tacky.chan@mahouse.gov. we do, again, prioritize emails to people that have immediate needs first. Getting, as you heard, a lot of questions about everything from bills and testimony and the appearing schedules, because people are already asking, down to the MBTA slowness, to people who still need unemployment, still happens, and those kind of challenges. And then, of course, we've got State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook, tackingchat.org, and of course, malegislature.gov. The public hearings of the state will be posted on malegislature.gov of the legislature. We'll no longer be using Facebook and Zoom. We'll be moving on to Microsoft Teams. So if you are, again, listening to this and you want to testify before any committee, it will be hybrid committees as we try to figure out how to do hybrid. So patience, everyone, as technology is not our friend all the time. But you're going to need Microsoft Teams on your device to testify virtually before any legislative committee. So a little bit of advice right there for you if you want to do that.
Sounds good. Appreciate it, Tacky, as always.
All right, Joe, I'll catch you next turn.
Sounds good. Take care.